everybody, Bill Buckmaster with you. Midweek edition already of Mr. Buckmaster on this side of the glass and Mr. Fairbanks, Tom Fairbanks, on the other side of the glass.
We're so formal today.
I know. What the heck, Tom Fairbanks, producing and engineering our program on this Wednesday, April 28th, 2021. We're in our 11th year on the radio in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. Our radio station is 1030. It's Tucson's voice for trusted news talk. Our call letters are KVOI. We have our worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com. Just did an upgrade on the site the other day. We've got an extensive archive that goes back to our first show on the radio after I left Channel 6 back in 2010. First show on the radio was the first week of 2011, and it's there, along with pretty much every show we have done here on the radio since then. The Buckmaster Show Live Line is presented by our friends at Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management. We have a lot to discuss concerning the drought and supporting desert agriculture in a changing climate. That's going to be our topic today with Dr. Jeff Silvertooth. Dr. Silvertooth is the Buckmaster contributor on agriculture. We're just so honored to have him and two dozen regular contributors to this program. Some great minds contribute their work and their thoughts to this show. Professor Silvertooth has been with the University of Arizona College of Agriculture and Life Sciences since 1987. He's current Associate Dean and Director for Extension and Economic Development, where he provides overall leadership and administrative and personnel management for the Arizona Cooperative Extension. Jeff, how are you?
I'm very good, Bill. Thank you. How are you doing?
Doing well. One of the researchers and became a really got some national publicity out of the UA College of Agriculture and Life Sciences in partnership with the USDA Agricultural Research Service. Dr. Smith, who we had on the program yesterday from the School of Natural Resources and Environment. The bottom line with his research, Jeff, is that periods of drought here in the Southwest and really in the West have become longer over the past 50 years. Things have gotten hotter. We've had less rainfall. And one of the figures that just jumps out at me is the average longest dry period has increased by roughly 50% from 20 to 32 days. In other words, there's that period we'll get some rain, then there's a longer period where we get some more.
Right. You know, that's consistent with what we have also seen. Probably was drawn, those results were probably drawn in part from the extensive database that exists with what we call the Arizona Meteorological Network. That's been initiated and directed by Dr. Paul Brown, who just retired about a year ago. But that program, the ASMET program, has been collecting meteorological data across Arizona for about 35 years solid, with about 32 stations. And that's outstanding quality of data. So it's good to have good quality meteorological data. But that's been very clear in the past three decades, Bill. The increasing temperatures and the increasing intensity of the drought. Now, we're in a solid 20 years of drought in the desert Southwest. And that's those studies that you're describing there from the Climate Science Hub with the U of A or the USDA, which our U of A participants work with, that's basically corroborating that on a large regional basis as well throughout the Southwest. But 20 years of solid drought right now, indicative of what you just described.
And the LA Times, in a piece today, said that this apparently is looking more and more, this 20-year drought, like a new normal. I hope that's not the case, Jeff Silvertooth, but it might be.
It might be. You know, Bill, as much as 20 years ago, the climate science models that were coming out were projecting Arizona, the desert Southwest, was going to grow hotter and drier. And wet places around the United States and certainly in, around the world would be at wet places of wetter and more intense with those kinds of storms. That's basically what we are seeing. And of course, there was a lot of argument against those models 20 years ago, and they were relatively new, but they've continued to refine them. And that's a difficult thing to do, to model climate that way. But they're showing pretty good patterns of consistency. Now, the LA Times comment about this is the new normal. That's one of the concerns we have, which is it's hard to look ahead to see this getting better, particularly with the parameters we have in the atmosphere that are driving this climate this way.
Professor Overpeck, who was at the University of Arizona, a really great climate scientist, went on now, I think he's up at Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan.
Right, he is.
I remember interviewing him years ago. I'm saying maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah.
On the television show, talking about what we are now experiencing, Jeff Silvertooth.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because that's exactly what I was thinking. I was working with Jonathan Overpeck.
Jonathan Overpeck.
20 years ago.
Great mind when it comes to whole area of climate change.
Yes, sir. And I was a relatively new department head in soil, water, and environmental science. And working with Jonathan Overpeck, we could see this coming. And we developed a position at that time, Jonathan and I together, in cooperative extension and climate science. Now, that's occupied now by an excellent scientist, Dr. Mike Crimmins.
Mm-hmm.
He was ultimately hired into that position. And we developed that not to solve all the problems in the world. We didn't have that kind of illusion. But we did believe that we needed to advance the education, get the information out to folks. So here's what the data, here's what the models are saying, here's the projections. Now, what do we do about it? Now, here we are in 2021, literally 21 years later, and we're wrestling with the consequences of some of those conditions that were projected 20 years ago. So that was Jonathan Overpeck and his colleagues that I was working with back then.
And I remember Overpeck talking about there would be rain. Certainly there would be rain, but it would come in more very intense spurts.
Right, right.
Like we have seen in this trailing off of what used to be, Jeff, the traditional monsoon. They used to say you could set your watch at 3 o'clock in the afternoon mm-hmm. during our monsoon and we get a thunderstorm. Those days apparently are gone.
It sure didn't happen last year.
It didn't happen last year. And last year turned out to be, we're hoping it's an anomaly, but that's the kind of year we talked about with Overpeck 20
right.
years ago, saying
right.
what happens if the monsoon doesn't show up?
Right.
Well, we got a taste of that last year.
We sure did. I thought of the same thing last year when we were seeing 108, 110 yes. degree temperatures in Tucson, southern Arizona, every day for months. And that was exactly what was described in a projection around 2001, 2002 with some of those models. And I remember Overpeck and his colleagues presenting that. I remember thinking about it at the time. That's like Yuma
mm-hmm.
every day
yeah.
in Tucson, you know, with a difference of 2,600 feet elevation. So I hope that doesn't hold out to be true, be a consistent pattern. But, you know, Bill, we have enough evidence thus far to give us due cause for concern.
Your colleagues are quoted, your colleagues in the ag field are quoted in this LA Times story today. So here, I'll read you a quote. The unfortunate reality is that some amount of farmland will probably have to go out of production to manage the reduced supply of water. Now, that presents a problem because it's called fallow land.
Mm-hmm,
that
right.
fallowed land creates air quality and water quality problems that will have to be addressed proactively.
All true. All true. You know, and the air quality problems are primarily associated with dust. You know, it's mm-hmm. hard to get natural revegetation in a desert environment like this. Same thing true in the places like the San Joaquin and southeastern California. But that's what we're facing. You know, right now, a good case in point is we're looking down the barrel on the probability of moving into what we call Tier 1 water reductions on the Colorado River for the CAP. That'll affect the CAP, the Central Arizona Project, most profoundly. And of the CAP reductions, it'll be reduced. Total CAP deliveries will be reduced on Tier 1 by about 30%, and that's 65% reduction of water allocated to agriculture, specifically in central Arizona, southern Arizona. Now, they're going to try to supplement that with groundwater wells, but just face it, there's some of those groundwater wells are not going to hold out. That was why we wanted to bring the CAP in the first place 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So they're what we're
because we don't want to use that groundwater. It's like a last resort.
Right.
You know, once you use that,
right,
bye-bye.
Right. Well, that's what was the greatest incentive to transfer those acres in central Arizona, agricultural acres, over to the CAP because it would be a more reliable source of water than to get us off of that groundwater. But that's what the only alternative those farmers have is to go back or get out.
Let's pause right here in our conversation with Jeff Silvertooth, talk some more about water and agriculture. But right now I want to talk, Jeff, about my favorite bakery in town. That's Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Have you been up to Mona's yet?
I haven't, Bill, but these advertisements sound pretty good, so well, I better get up there.
Let me get your mouth watering here. Mona's, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. They're open right now for lunch, and they are famous for their Scandinavian pastry that's called a Danish Kringle. And as our friend Tom Fairbanks has described it, light and tasty multi-layered pastry. There you go. Nice slogan by Tom Fairbanks coming up that for Mona's. Mona's Danish Bakery, again, they're at the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. We had breakfast out on their patio on Sunday. Very pleasant. Always a great breakfast there. They open during the week at 6:30 in the morning for the breakfast. Again, they are open right now for lunch. We'll be back talking water and agriculture with Jeff Silvertooth right after this.
Vets working hard to save wildlife covered in cactus spines. A skunk left for dead, miraculously saved by a caring citizen. Those are just a couple of the headlines from the nonprofit Tucson Animal Rescue Center, where thousands of animals are cared for each year at its state-of-the-art Far East Side Tucson facility. Rescue, rehab, and release. The Tucson Wildlife Center, saving wildlife for more than two decades. Donate online at TucsonWildlife.com or call 290-WILD.
This is Bill Buckmaster. You've heard me talk about choosing Tucson International Airport. While fewer people are traveling lately, our airport is doing even more these days to help ensure traveler health safety, including counter safety shields, physical distancing markers, enhanced cleaning, and more. It's called TUS Cares, and you can learn more at flytucson.com. These may be different times, but my priority remains to fly Tucson, Tucson International Airport.
Why is mining so important? It's the foundation of everything that defines a society. Everything you see is a product of mining. No matter when, no matter how, no matter why, every society on this planet has developed, grown, and modernized based solely on the minerals it could process. That, my friend, is why mining is so important.
Brought to you by the Southern Arizona Business Coalition.
A Citizens Advisory Committee of the Regional Transportation Authority is starting to review projects submitted by RTA member jurisdictions for consideration for the next RTA plan. The committee will consider plan goals and performance factors as they move into the selection process. The RTA will seek public feedback on the committee's draft plan when it is ready. Learn more about plan goals and sign up to stay informed at rtanext.com.
Vero Amore Restaurant in Plaza Palomino at Fort Lowland Swan and Dove Mountain in Marana are now open for limited in-restaurant and patio dining, along with takeout and home delivery. All of your favorite Vero Amore menu items, including Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, are ready for you and your friends and family. More at VeroAmorePizza.com.
The Green Valley News and Sorita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sorita Sun, it's all right here.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100. Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show, our midweek edition. We're in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. Our live line is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management, and we continue now with Dr. Jeff Silvertooth, our contributor on agriculture in our program. And this man has had a very impressive career in ag, and he's been with the University of Arizona College of Agriculture and Life Sciences since 1987, and currently doing all sorts of good things over there as Associate Dean and Director for Extension, among other things. So when you look at the water, there's just so much water, obviously, on the Colorado River, and there's so many people, Jeff Silvertooth, who want that water. It goes back to this compact that was drawn up, I guess next year would mark the 100th anniversary of the Colorado River Compact. What was that? How did that come about? What was this designed to do?
Well, you know, that's an interesting story, probably more than we have time for here today. But that occurred in 1922, bringing all the states associated with the full base, with full Colorado River watershed together, all the way from the mountain states of, you know, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, lower basin states consisting of, well, also New Mexico is involved because of the San Juan River watershed. You know, there's Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, mm-hmm. California, and even Mexico. Mexico is involved as well. It's not part of the United States, but it's part of the Colorado River watershed. And they brought all those states together, and they divided the basins from upper basin, lower basin. And what they did is they took 1 year worth of hydrological data, mm-hmm. and they said there's about 15 million acre feet of flow through the Colorado River. So they allocated 7.5 million acre feet to the upper basin, which is basically above Lake Powell, mm-hmm. and the lower basin, 7.5 million acre feet, which goes from below Lake Powell down to the Sea mm-hmm. of Cortez. Mm-hmm. And we've worked with that ever since. The problem began right away in the next decade after the compact was agreed upon, was to realize that the annual flow is more like 13 million acre feet. Mm-hmm. So there was already almost a structural deficit built into the budgeting on the water right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And we've just, you know, continued with it ever since. So there's been all kinds of adjustments, but that's the beginning of what we call the law of the river, mm-hmm. which is an amalgam of lots of laws and rules and little alterations to that original compact. But that's the source. That's the original core agreement.
But when you think about it, here's this one river, the Colorado River, and there are all these people. You know, 1922 is a different landscape. Right. You know, post-World War I here in the West, it was a completely different landscape. Now you have all these people that are dependent on water from the Colorado River, and you see the real estate like Phoenix.
Right.
Considered one of the hottest real estate markets, so is Tucson.
Right.
More and more people moving here.
Right.
How in the world are we ever going to sustain that growth and sustain what we have in agriculture?
Well, as we look ahead, I think we also have to look back a little bit. And you look back and you see, well, like you say, 1922 is a very different landscape than what we see today, 100 years later. And what was happening then, they knew they had to have water in this region to basically
survive.
Support a population.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, you know, you have a deal where you have California has allocated something like 4.4 million acres of that 7.5 in the lower basin, yet they only contribute, they being the landscape, contributes about 1% in the watershed to the Colorado River for
it's
water.
It's a small portion.
It's a small portion of contribution, but the driving force is the population. Mm-hmm. So now you have 25, 30 million people in Southern California alone that this water helps support. So, you know, it just exemplifies the fact that always water has been the lifeblood of this entire region, the entire Southwest. And we're here, we move forward 100 years later, and we're still dealing with those same constraints, but now they're even tighter because we have increasing population, a drought on top of it, less water, more people, more demand. And the questions we come down to is how do we divide it up? And that's where we are facing today as we look down on this drought and how do we manage it with this drought contingency plan and facing tier one restrictions that are possibly forecast right now to come upon us this next year.
Let's take cotton, for example, and the way that acreage, and you know best about this, but I think it's been shrinking because of the urban demands, not only from the Tucson area, but look at the way Phoenix has expanded to the south.
span it to the south, to the west, to the east, to the north, every direction. But it's that agricultural land to the west, east, and south has been consumed by urbanization in the past 30 years.
Yes.
So we were for a while there, and we were losing about 1,000 acres a year, 1,000 acres a year just in central Arizona.
Cotton farmers saying, why should I continue to farm when I can sell that land for probably a good price?
Sure. If you and I were to go up today to Maricopa County, to the West Valley, out around Buckeye, and that whole area out there where the Cardinal Stadium is now, out around Glendale, all of that was in agriculture. And those farmers, a lot of them I knew, most of them I knew. Mm-hmm. And that was exactly the prospect they faced back when the boom was going on.
I can remember back when I first came out here, the first time I lived in Tucson, came out here as a kid from Chicago area to go to the University of Arizona in the late 60s. My girlfriend, who is now my wife, lived up in Phoenix, so I would drive that drive between Tucson and Phoenix. It was actually right at the time when the freeway had been extended, because there was a period there where freeway ended at Florence.
Right.
But anyway, what I'm trying to say is, from Tucson, after you got outside Marana, or even right at Marana, almost until you reached Baseline Road, this is the 60s.
Right.
It was all agriculture.
Right.
It was all cotton.
Well, I came here in 87, as you mentioned, and we had 500,000 acres of cotton alone here in Arizona. We had a little over 1 million acres of total crop production and of 500,000 acres annually of irrigated cotton. And now it's down to a little over 100,000, about 80,000 acres, about 100,000 acres. Down, it depends. I'm not sure what we'll have this year. Markets are up, actually, so we might have a little more. But anyway, it has diminished. It's been diminished as a function of two things, land and availability, and just pure economics. As the cotton market has gone down, water prices go up, demand changes, so it shifts the acreage always in agriculture. But there's just flat less land to support agriculture in Arizona, and there's going to continue to be less land, particularly in central Arizona, based on the projections of population growth.
Are there any small cotton farmers left, or is it pretty much now all conglomerates?
Depends what we mean by small. out here is a relative term, but there are small cotton producers, but you have to have some. There's an economics to scale, so you have to have the proper equipment. You have to have proximity to a gin, the things like that. Somehow to pick a crop to harvest it. Mm-hmm. So there's an equipment demand that most people have. Yeah, well, everyone has. And so there's this limitation on how many farmers can get into it. But there are probably not too many more people going to get into the business these days.
No.
You know, it's a question of, can these farms continue?
And then you have to look at this. These cotton farmers may be saying, look, they may see the handwriting on the wall with this water situation. You were just saying earlier in our interview that the water will be cut back to Arizona agriculture, and they will have to make it up with going into groundwater.
That's right.
Some of them may say, if I got a good buyer right now, I'm going to take it.
I think probably a lot of them would. You know, it's they're looking out for their families.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the folks that sold out in the West Valley, East Valley, 15 years ago. They were just looking out for their families and looking ahead. And if those things were to be, if they were to confront those kinds of economic choices, it'd be a pretty tough one for a lot of them.
So the water and agriculture picture of the future will be crops that are less dependent on water? And what would those type of crops be? And we've talked on this program about hemp. I have no idea if it's a big water user.
Well, the thing about it agronomically is to produce any kind of dry matter, which plants do, what we want. It takes water. And the more dry matter you produce, the more water it takes to do it, particularly in a nice, warm environment like we live in. And so when you're looking at a crop, if you want to have substantial yield to be able to pay back your expenses for growing a crop, you need to grow it in enough dry matter. In this case, like cotton, that would be retranslated to cotton bowls, cotton plants and cotton bowls. And so cotton consumes water, but it consumes water in proportion to the amount of production it provides, and it produces well under good conditions out here in this desert. So what we are seeing is the constant search for more valuable crops. If you want to grow a crop that uses less water, whatever you produce better be worth a lot. that's basically what we're dealing with. So you go places like Southwest Arizona, you don't see hardly any cotton around the Yuma area anymore. It's a rotation crop today, secondary rotation crop. Mm-hmm. The primary crop for winter, vegetable, leafy green produce crops. Mm-hmm. And that's where the market is. It's where the money is. It's where we have the production capacity. And wherever we go, people are looking for an optimization of how can I use my resources. And out here, water's the number one resource mm-hmm. on top mm-hmm. of our land mm-hmm. to produce a crop and do so economically and provide a crop that someone wants.
Then getting back to the in-migration, the people moving here, you got to wonder, are they asking themselves, maybe they just think there's going to be plenty of water forever mm-hmm. in Arizona, but you would think that one of the things they would be thinking about is this sustainable?
Yeah, you absolutely. You know, one of the things that's happening, we mentioned in this tier one reduction
yes.
with the CAP and in the drought contingency plan, 65% of the water that goes to agriculture today will be cut out. That constitutes a 30% reduction on the CAP. There will be zero reductions to municipal and industrial purposes and to the tribes. And so people right now today, when they come here, they're going to hear, your water's not in being threatened. Water's not in jeopardy. It's basically true, for the next probably 10 years.
Yes.
But if you're coming here to get into agriculture in Central Arizona, it'd be a different story.
Now, the long term, that could be a different story.
Yes,
you might be good. You might be good for 10 years, but I don't know. Things changing
right.
very, very quickly. Jeff Silvertooth, always a pleasure. Thank
yes, sir.
You very
Thank you,
much.
Bill.
Thanks a lot.
Yes, sir.
All right. Coming up next, we've got Will Humble for his monthly visit with us. Will is the former director of the Arizona Department of Health. We'll have a COVID-19 update, all sorts of things to talk with Will about. It's Buckmaster Midweek Edition in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio. We'll be right back.
Have you ever imagined how your life would be without the modern conveniences you rely on every day? Everything you need depends entirely on products produced from mining. Without mining, think Stone Age. Your work commute might be a bit slower, but you could still have social media. Bathing shouldn't be a problem, but it won't be in a tub. So unless you're a caveman, you can see everything that enriches your life depends on the many miracles from mining. Brought to you by the Southern Arizona Business Coalition.
As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com.
Are you searching for a sumptuous suite on the Italian Riviera, an exploration of the mighty Mississippi, or an indulgent spa in Cancun? Bon Voyage Travel will help you find exactly the vacation you're looking for anywhere in the world. With many cruises setting sail in over 1,100 hotels and resorts to choose from with our exclusive benefits, Bon Voyage Travel's experienced advisors are here to guide you every step of the way. Visit bvtravel.com or call 797-1110.
Enjoy the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at Tucson's original gastropub, Noble Hops in Oro Valley. Savor the view while sipping on locally brewed craft beer and enjoying gastropub fine fare. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies, at West Lambert Lane at North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley, and on the web at noblehops.com.
Green Things is a family-owned and operated plant nursery serving Tucson since 1970. Open daily at 3384 East River Road, Green Things is chock full of plants and pottery from around the world. Green Things is also now home to Zocalo, featuring fine Mexican and South American imports spread over five buildings on the 13-acre Green Things property. For more, visit greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Southern Arizona is home to one of the world's most trusted sources of information on medicines. The Credible Meds website is visited each day by over 2,000 people from more than 60 countries. You too can learn how to personalize your medications and take control of your health care. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and join Bill Buckmaster each month as he and Dr. Ray Woosley, founder of Credible Meds, give you practical tips on how to get the most from your medications.
Reed Park Zoo is now open for wildlife walks, a modified guest experience, prioritizing social distancing and safety. To find out more about all the changes and the new safety precautions now in place, visit reedparkzoo.org. The community-approved 10-year master plan ensures that your zoo's future is brighter than ever before. We've missed you, and so have the animals. They're waiting to welcome you back to the Reed Park Zoo.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show midweek edition. We are in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. How about some gardening this weekend? We had a little, well, I don't know, we had a 2 to 3 minute rain shower up at our house yesterday. I mean, a little bit of rain is certainly better than nothing, but it would be a great weekend to get some gardening done, and that means heading over to our great sponsor, Green Things and Zocalo Village. Zocalo Village, 5 freestanding buildings within the 13-acre Green Things site, and that's where you can find some beautiful handmade furniture like these mesquite tables. They are gorgeous. They're all handcrafted. A lot of them come from Mexico. However, some of the mesquite is done right here in Tucson. They've got some handcrafted items from mesquite tables from Tucson. Anyway, they're open daily, 3384 East River Road, greenthingsaz.com, and zocalovillage.com. Will Humble has been joining us now every month. We're glad he does. Pretty much every month since the pandemic began in March of 2020. Will is the former director of health services. He was the director from 2009 to 2015. He's the current executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association of Arizona. And Will, Will, how are you, first of all? Doing well? Will, are you with us? Oh, did we lose him, Tom?
Oh, yeah, no. Oh. Sorry, I had you on mute. Sorry.
Sorry about that. I thought maybe you had gone to take care of some other business, or you had me on. Yeah, there you go. You had me on mute. Anyway, yeah. I have been looking at your blog, which is really good. You put that out, try to put that out every couple days from the Arizona Public Health Association.
Yeah. I put a new blog post almost every day. Yeah,
I want to begin with the blog you had about masks, the governor and masks in schools. I think it was just last night down here, the Vail School Board, there was like a revolt. Parents just furious about a mask mandate in the Vail School District. What's your take on this, Will Humble?
I thought it was such a silly decision by Governor Ducey and Director Crist to pull that with only about, in most districts, 23 school days left in the semester. You know, faculty, staff, students, teachers have all gotten used to the masks. We still are in moderate to substantial spread. I don't know about the Vail District, but most of the state is still in moderate spread. So it makes sense to protect kids. Obviously, kids can't get vaccinated, so they're all susceptible for the most part, unless they've been infected and recovered already. I just thought it would have been a lot more sensible for the governor and Director Crist to just let the mask mandate ride out through the end of the semester and then let it go throughout the summer, you know, drop it once school's out. I don't think we're going to need it in the fall, but I just think it really put school board members, which their job has been hard enough over this last year, in a really tough position. And by the way, wasting a bunch of time on this. And I saw the pictures from down in Vail on KVOA last night. And that's a direct result of the policy decision that Crist and Ducey made. I just think it was foolish. And quite honestly, it made those elected governing board members' jobs just a lot more difficult for no good reason.
And you say in the blog that the Ducey and Crist have really made some bad policy decisions over the last year. What's at the top of the list, Will Humble?
There's two things that come to mind right at the top of the list. Number one was about almost exactly a year ago today. It's actually a year ago next week. That was when we left the stay-at-home order and went into a purely voluntary system when it came to mitigation measures. You can remember we had a really, I think up until at this point a year ago, they were both doing a good job. the stay-at-home orders were successful. The essential businesses and activities were defined well, I thought. We left that stay-at-home order with an executive order that he issued about a year ago next week. And that moved from the stay-at-home order into an environment where bars, restaurants, and nightclubs could open, and they were encouraged but not required to do any kind of mitigation whatsoever. And that, over the course of June, led to the lethal July that we had. So I think that came to mind as probably one of the, in the top three bad mistakes that they made, really. They're in it together. The second was right before Thanksgiving, when they all the data and modeling showed that we were going to go into exponential spread and lose a lot of lives throughout December, January, and February if they didn't do anything with respect to required mitigation measures, or at least enforcement of the mitigation measures that were on paper. They didn't do any of that, and I wasn't suggesting the stay-at-home order in November, just real enforcement of what was on paper required mitigation measures. Those, plus the fact that throughout all of June, up until June 30th, he actually prevented local jurisdictions, prohibited local jurisdictions from putting mask mandates in place. He finally relented, but he could have showed the leadership that states like Montana governor showed and many others, and had a statewide mask mandate throughout the entire pandemic. So those are three of many things that were policy. There were also lots of operational shortcomings. And I wrote a 12-page paper on it, so I won't bore you with the details, but those are some basics.
Now, the vaccine rollout continues to really, there have been a lot of mistakes, Will, and we have got to look at convenience. If we are ever going to reach herd immunity, things are going to have to change on how vaccine is prioritized by these seven state-financed point-of-distribution sites.
Yes, I agree with you totally. Is that, you know, the state-financed and mostly university-run sites, and there's seven of them around the state, had their role early on. I mean, early on, the name of the game was just get as much vaccine out as you possibly could to these employment groups, you know, healthcare workers with recreation care and others. And so the mass vaccination sites had their place. I think they were over allocated, but they had at least a role to play. But now that we have exhausted the people that were willing to go to those big mass vaccination sites, we need to have a much more convenient way of getting this vaccine out. And I think they're allocating, I think this week they allocated 200,000 doses to those state financed sites. And I think that vaccine could have been better used by county health departments like Pima County, who's doing a terrific job, by the way, with a lot more of these pop-up type of clinics, things in, you know, in churches and community centers, pop-up events in the community to help bring up our vaccination rates. And the other thing, and you haven't mentioned this yet, but it's a big deal, which is we need to get to the place where these are all walk-in sites, including the pharmacies,
right?
So that you don't have to make an appointment in advance. We're entering a phase where spontaneity and convenience are going to be the name of the game. We're there now for a lot of people. Younger people in their 20s and 30s with a couple of jobs, maybe students, men are 20 points behind women in vaccines.
Wow.
We've got to get more men vaccinated. And you look at the literature, and the name of the game for them is spontaneity. They need to know that they can walk into a Walgreens without an appointment, and they're not vaccine hesitant, and it's not political. It's just that they don't plan in advance. I guess I can say this because I am one. but women are just better at planning by and large when it comes to healthcare and navigating the system. And so spontaneity is important, and that means getting rid of the appointment system and have it be walk-in like it is with your influenza shot.
I think one state off the top, West Virginia, actually bypassed these big sites, and they went directly to the pharmacy system, and they did pretty well with their vaccine rollout.
Yeah, no, I think we're to that point now where making the pharmacies easier and have a bigger supply at the pharmacies that would allow them to do walk-ins is really a key. But you can't do that if you're still allocating 40% of your annual or your weekly supply to these seven state-financed, university-run sites. The Tucson one is down at the U of A.
All right, we're going to pause right here with Will Humble. We'll be right back with Will as we take our break. Midweek edition of the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. Be right back. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is once again welcoming guests to the gallery. Stop by or call ahead for a one-on-one appointment or even a virtual design session. Come by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, located at the southwest corner of Fort Lowell and Dodge. The number is 795-8226 and on the web at moesgallery.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Hello, I'm Danette Bewley, President and CEO of the Tucson Airport Authority, with news of our new effort to ensure air traveler safety and security going through our terminal. It's called TUS Cares, and you can read more about it on our website, flytucson.com. As you carefully weigh your decision to fly, I want you to know whether it's next week, next month, or next year, we are here for you at Tucson International Airport. Thank you.
The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax, which expires in June 2026. To prepare for ongoing project delivery, the RTA board established a Citizens Advisory Committee to select projects for a new draft plan. The committee will help identify which projects to invest in to best meet regional transportation needs. Learn more about plan development and provide early input at rtanext.com.
Hi, this is Pam Krim, CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona, where we set the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the place to turn for objective and unbiased information on businesses. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona at bbb.org/Tucson.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show presented by Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. Just looking at the current temperature over in Silver City, I like it. This is fireplace weather, 41 degrees at 1 o'clock. They're an hour ahead of us over on Mountain Time in New Mexico, and rain, which is really good news. Especially after our discussion about the drought in the first portion of the program. So things starting to look up. Be a great weekend to go over to Silver City. Nice and cool at 5,000 to 7,000 feet, somewhere around there. Only about a three-hour drive. Lots to do, like doing some hiking in the Gila National Wilderness. Great places to stay. All of it is available for you at southwestnewmexico.org. And by the way, the weekend forecast, it's perfect in Silver City, anywhere from 72 to 79 degrees by Sunday, and Tucson will be at about 98 degrees. So there you go. That's usually, we say, about 15, and it can be 20 degrees cooler in Silver City. Let's go now on the live line, our live line presented by Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management. Will Humble is with us. Will has joined us every month and will continue to for the foreseeable future during pandemic times. Will's the former director of the Arizona Health Services. He was there from 2009 to 2015. He's current executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. You may want to Google them and get involved with looking at Will's blogs that he puts out. What's the website for that, Will?
AZPHA.org. So we're the Arizona Public Health Association.
Okay. You know, I want to talk a bit about messaging from the CDC. This woman, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, a couple of weeks ago, she was going down the path of Dr. Osterholm, our friend up at the University of Minnesota, who tends to get, let's say he's over the top. So she kind of went over the top at about the same time he did with her series of comments about she had this sense of impending doom, and was ready to start crying. And now she's saying that she's hopeful. So good Lord, what in the world with the messaging on the CDC?
Yeah, no, I mean, by and large, I have a lot of respect for her. And so far, since she took office, in January, she's done a good job. But that statement, when I heard it, I kind of cringed and I thought, what is she talking about? I mean, the vaccine is rolling out. Yes, it's not perfect, but we're getting seniors vaccinated. The hospital situation is getting better. Yes, there are some new variants that are posing a problem in some states. Fortunately, we got that 1117 variant later than Michigan did. And so we got a lot more people vaccinated before that became the dominant strain. But I don't know why. I don't know what. I think it was a Friday. I don't know what she was doing that day. But it was uncharacteristic, really, because she has done a good job by and large.
All right. How do we overcome vaccine hesitancy? There was a letter to the editor in today's New York Times, and the letter writer said, you know, in order to get people, you brought up going to making it easier. That would be one path. This writer says we need to do some kind of other incentive rather than making it easy, like perhaps a one-time tax break for those getting vaccinated.
Oh, I here's the thing. Here's the way I look at it. Number one, the next group of people we need to get are not vaccine hesitant, but those are, and I will just use the word, lazy men who haven't done it yet, right?
Yeah.
They don't need it. They need their wife or girlfriend or whoever to make the appointment for them, and they'll do it. But I think we got to focus right now on convenience, making this easier, getting rid of the appointments, and do that part of it. Now, for that next group that you're talking about, which is the vaccine hesitant, those people that are worried and haven't gotten vaccine because they have questions, the literature shows that it's very clear. They trust their doctor or their nurse practitioner first, their healthcare provider. So that means we need to get more vaccine into doctors' offices so that when they're in for an annual physical, for a checkup, that their doctor can reach out to them individually and say, it's time for your vaccine. They can come in, spend 15 minutes with them, reassure them about the vaccine, but they have to close the deal right then and there.
Yep.
And right now, the state is hogging the vaccines for these sites, these big sites, and not allocating it to doctors' offices. And so you could go to your doctor and they could talk to you about the vaccine, but if they can't close the deal while you're in the office, you're not going to be successful. So we got to get vaccine into doctors' offices. And this is what I'm doing advocacy on this week to try to get the state health department to loosen up and stop taking so much of the allocation for these mega sites and send it to doctor's offices for those people that have questions.
That just makes so much common sense, because we've all had, you know, we go to the doctor for a physical or whatever, and the doctor will say, now, what about your vaccinations, namely the tetanus shot that you're supposed to get every 10 years? And then they could, if they had the vaccine right there, they could say, now, what about COVID? Have you had the shot? And they said, well, no, I haven't had a chance to get it. Well, I could give it to you right now.
Right now.
That closes the deal. I like
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But right now, there's an executive order. It's called Executive Order 2020-62. Governor Ducey signed it in late December. It made sense at the time, and it made it so that it prioritized the vaccine to these mega sites. And it put onerous restrictions on doctors ordering vaccine because they were afraid that they wouldn't use it fast enough. And that executive order is still in place. And I've done some tweets and done some advocacy this week just trying to get them to take that executive order back, resend it, so that we can get doctors the vaccine so that they can get to the people that are hesitant. That plus making it more convenient for the people that aren't hesitant but just haven't done it. They need to be able to walk into a pharmacy without an appointment. And we could do both of those things by changing the way we allocate vaccines.
Have you heard anything about your request, or is it they say crickets?
Bill, they're so mad at me.
You're kind of like, Will, you're like this thorn in their side to Dr. Crist.
So.
And Dr. Crist used to be your assistant, number one, right?
Yeah, she was my deputy. I promoted her three times. I know they're really mad at me. And I'm not trying to make them look bad. I'm trying to guide them towards better policy decisions and better operational decisions. But they see it as like a threat, I think, or that I'm being critical for like as a sport, as opposed to seeing it like, actually, perhaps we should have listened to him on that.
Can you? Oh, I'd like to be a fly on the wall during their weekly meeting. Will's at it again. Oh, he was on that Buckmaster show down in Tucson. He's bad mouthing our department again. Boy, what are we going to do?
I do want to add something to that, which is the thing that makes me kind of not anxious, but. The thing about this that bothers me the most of my advocacy is that I really hope that my team, there was 2,000 people at that agency, and I really hope that the team there doesn't interpret my remarks as being critical of them as individual hard workers, because my grievances have been about the policy decisions from the top. It's not about the staff. It's about the very top senior leadership person.
And you know, they say, and this happens when people leave places, oh, he's sour grapes. Will went on to do other things. But in 2015, he left. And, you know, he's sour grapes.
Yeah, well, I hope that's not it.
All right. Herd immunity, what's it going to take? Give us a percentage. What's your best guess now in Arizona?
I think we need another 15% of Arizona's adults to be vaccinated. So we need to keep our momentum going. We need more men to go in and get vaccinated. We need to do a better job of getting into the lower income communities, not in Pima County. You guys are doing a good job. Just keep what you're doing in Pima. But we've got to do a better job of that. We need to loosen things up in the pharmacy so that there's no appointments needed. And then I think within, say, 6 weeks, we could be at a point where we're at herd immunity. But, Bill, remember,
quickly,
herd immunity doesn't mean that this is zero cases.
Right.
What it means is that it's a sporadic disease. It will still be around, but it will no longer be a public health emergency.
All right, Will Humble, we'll talk to you soon. Thank you, Will.
Take care.
That'll do it for the Buckmaster Show. We've got Dave Ramsey coming up next, thanks to Tom Fairbanks, hitting all the right buttons today. Yeah. Have a great afternoon, everybody.